Chapter 15, the last chapter of the book in Anand Viraraj's Green History of Religion. Title of the chapter, Cosmic Homelessness. Religion is at the heart of any culture. Religion defines and provides meaning to the culture. Culture moves and motivates societies. Societies are set within bioregions, and bioregions are set within continental spheres, and ultimately within the planetary context. Changes in the wider spheres affect changes in smaller spheres. As societies evolve, they interact with changes in local, regional, and global spheres. The effects of these interactions may be either creative or destructive, both to the environment and to the societies. All religions strive to provide a comprehensive frame of reference, the meaning of human presence and experience in the universe. They do not merely transmit historical and cultural artifacts. Rather, they attempt to apprehend the whole gamut of human experience and presence, both within and without. Religion also attempts to apprehend what takes place outside history. Joseph Campbell calls these sacred dreams and says they articulate events and realities that are beyond human rationality and the senses. They expound the creation of the universe and the human presence within it in a non-scientific way. Sacred dreams make mundane events such as sunrise and sunset, thunder and lightning, earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, tsunamis, drought, eclipses, comets, comprehensible and meaningful to ordinary humans in non-scientific language, and present them as the frolicking or skirmishes of gods, sacred beings, or semi-divine heroes and heroines. They take into account the complexity of the role and place of many agents constituting a situation or causing a particular event to happen. Even non-human nature, both animate and inanimate, is seen as taking an active and intentional role in events. Much of this meaning is wrapped up in myths and cultic exercises. Ultimately, religious myths invite humans to apprehend and share realities beyond those that are observable and can be experienced and verified in time and space. Myth-making is universal. And as an audio reader's side note, we now know, such as Stuart Guthrie has written about in his Oxford University Press 1992 book, Faces in the Clouds, Toward a New Theory of Religion. We now know that the reason that myth-making is universal is because of the human brain's propensity to personify, that is, to give human characteristics to what's other than human or more than human. So myth-making is universal, and some common themes and motifs run through myths of every culture and age. A study of comparative mythology shows that many figures, such as sky gods, earth goddesses, gods of vegetation, the divine child, and the virgin mother, are found widely in divergent cultures. Carl Jung maintains that these common themes occur in all cultures because they are archetypes, derived from the collective unconsciousness of the human psyche. Archetypes of the primal and archaic myths have an integrated and comprehensive approach to the events of the past and to human presence, experience, and aspirations in the world. One of these new myths that has come to imbue most axial traditions is this notion of cosmic homelessness, a sense of being lost in the cosmos. A classic example of this sentiment is found in the words of this popular gospel song composed by William Walker. Quote, "This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore." John F. Haught, writing about this, says, quote, "Is not one of the major themes of the religions that we should feel out of joint and even out of place in our immediate environment? Ever since the so-called axial period, from about the middle centuries of the first millennium BCE, some of the major traditions have had strong otherworldly leanings and have promoted spiritual disciplines that have made us feel alien to the physical universe. At times, these traditions have asked us to withdraw from the world since, quote, we have no lasting home here," unquote. Homelessness has been idealized rather than suppressed, unquote. Is soteriology all about homelessness and pie in the sky? We recognize that an important component of the soteriology we absorb and live by is this homelessness. Human negativity toward the world of nature and the sense of cosmic homelessness go hand in hand. These ideas evolved and crystallized as humans crossed successive thresholds, and by the dawn of the Axial Age, these ideas were sealed completely. It has to be reckoned that this trait of homelessness is a recent phenomenon, and a brief one considering the lengthy history of Homo sapiens on planet Earth. It has been in existence for a mere 3,000 to 4,000 years, while Homo sapiens have inhabited the planet for almost 400,000 years as hunters and gatherers. The dominant disposition of the primal people has been one of being at home. Primal myths and cults affirmed the providence of nature and integrated human presence and experiences with the process and events of nature. Nature, the great magma mater, provided the overarching frame of reference of human existence and experience. The process and cycles of nature provided ever-present meaning for human existence. Humans, along with all the flora and fauna, were viewed as those that made up the family of the magma mater. All constituent entities were actively involved in the enduring cosmic drama. The drama was enacted, affirmed, recounted, and experienced repeatedly through communal rituals, dances, totemic cults, and shamans, magic, and medicine. They together affirmed the permanence and benevolence of nature. Categories for the narratives were drawn from the mythical taxonomies of nature. Such taxonomies show continuities rather than contrasts between the human and non-human world. These were reflected in the way human experiences were narrated and enacted through animal characters and stories. Primal people held that animal spirits could cross over with ease and indwell humans and vice versa. Stories of humans as well as of the spirits and the supernatural forces were all enmeshed in narratives of nature. Nature was the organizing ground for both humans and the divine. Thus, the primal narratives celebrated nature and affirmed her essential benevolence and bounties. Nature was, for the primal people, indeed enchanted. No wonder our primal ancestors truly felt at home in this world. Then came the agrarian revolution with its distinction between humans and nature. Archaic agrarians looked upon nature as something that could be modified to human ends. The unity motifs of the primal myths gave way to motifs of mutuality and partnership between different entities. The sky gods and the earth goddesses, though distinct, were not antagonistic to each other. Instead, they interacted with each other to ensure the fecundity of both humans and nature through the ever-changing cycles and seasons. Agrarian revolution was structured on the fertility ideology, an ideology that affirmed the procreative purposes of all entities in nature. The myths conveyed mutuality between humans, nature, and gods. God could be easily enticed and domesticated. So was nature. Archaic agrarians saw continuity between humanity and nature and held that their destinies were intimately bonded. During the ancient urban epoch, humans came to view themselves as somewhat distinct from nature and not caught up in its vagaries and cycles. Nature was viewed instead as that which existed for human pleasure and welfare, and, therefore, humans had the right to deal with it as they pleased. The distancing of humans from nature enabled societies to control and direct the course of their immediate environment rather than being controlled by it. Humans became, in their own eyes at least, masters of nature and saw themselves placed above nature. In this context, the art of myth-making assumed an ideological twist. A gradual emergence of a dichotomy between different characters of the drama can be observed. The mutuality and the compatibility of the archaic epic came to assume somewhat rigid, autonomous, and confrontational roles. The characters of the archaic players, gods, humans, and nature, who till then were mutually bonded, began to diverge and seek their own destinies. For the first time, it seemed feasible and appropriate to narrate the story of humans detached from the stories of nature and gods. Yet the monads did not completely walk away from each other. All that happened was that the power relations between the players, gods, humans, and nature, were beginning to be defined in a hierarchical order. Primal egalitarianism and archaic agrarian mutualism gave way to hierarchy, domination, and control. Primal and agrarian myths were thus recast to reflect the transformation taking place both in the society and on the environmental front. Stories of both gods and nature were subsumed in the story of humans. humans, who until then were integrated with the primal myths, were extricated from nature's clasp and syndicated more with the saga of gods. The hierarchical order required mediators between God and nature. The Babylonian creation myths, which provide the basic motifs for the biblical stories of creation, the Garden of Eden, and Noah's Ark, show that the essential role for which humans were created was to take care of God's creation. Accordingly, God had to create humans in God's image and put them as superintendents of the creation. And God remained ever vigilant to ensure that humans carried out the tasks entrusted to them. Should something go awry, God would have to destroy all humans and nature and make way for a new order to emerge. Such motifs could only grow within an urban agrarian economy and ethos whose ideology fostered the idea that nature, as well as the common folk, agrarian laborers, artisans, and women, by themselves are unruly and not sagacious, and that they can only be fecund and productive so long as the urban gentry exercise power, control, and domination over them. Nature is no longer the arena of divine creativity, and when it fails or does not respond the way humans want, it becomes evil in their sight. And all those who are closely associated with Mother Earth, farmers, herdsmen, laborers, artisans, tribal people, primal people, women and children, are of low esteem and prone to evil. It is now left to humans to deal with nature as they please, and if humans could not set it right, humans have the option to create their own brave world, a new world of the walled city. Sumer embodies the essence of ancient urban ideology. Urbanism is the second great revolution in human cultural evolution. The essential ideology of history, the rejection of nature, was witnessed for the first time in cities of Sumer and Greece. The urbanite outlook on nature was rather ambivalent. Nature was viewed not so much as a sphere of human subsistence, but as an impediment to human advance or an evil force from which humans should flee. For this reason, they created a world away from the menacing wilderness. Such an ideology was backed by the view that nature was chaotic and therefore needed to be dominated, controlled, and ordered by human ingenuity and interventions. Ancient urban civilization is marked by fortified cities. They serve as the symbols of security and power for the whole land. A fortress on a citadel, with a monarch and his palace at the center with a central temple or cultic site, served as the organizing principle for the whole land. The ancient urban myth was symbolized in fortified cities. Walled cities symbolized permanence, security, and hope for the citizens. Captives, foreigners, sojourners, and caravan traders of the ancient world always turned in the direction of their central cultic cities for daily prayers. Urbanites could now withdraw and insulate themselves from the menacing wilderness, boorish agrarians and artisans, and marauding tribes. From the security of walled cities, elites could now safely domesticate, control, and direct the wild world and the common folk out there. Sumerian myths thus came to narrate the divine human drama against the backdrop of a menacing nature and marauding tribes that needed to be crushed and subdued. Nature was no longer an active partner, but a villain. Rather, humans, and especially the males, became the most important players. While the saga of humans and gods were syndicated, nature provided the plot for the drama to be unfolded. Urban ideologies of the Mesopotamian deserts thus hastened the parting of gods, humans, and nature from one another. While the Sumerians sought to subdue nature, the Greeks of classical times demythologized nature. Greek philosophers sought to understand nature in rational and scientific terms. In trying to understand the world rationally, Greeks sought to eschew myths of nature and sought to replace it with logos. Logos is rational, pragmatic, and scientific. If the world can be understood in terms of causes and effects, humans will function well within it and exercise greater control over nature. Unlike mythos, that merely provides the overarching meaning of existence, logos understands facts that correspond to realities as they exist. Rational understanding of the world opens the way to discover new things in nature. Logos helps to create novel things that enhance human welfare and enjoyment. But logos has its limitations. It cannot assuage evil in the world and human pain and sorrow. It cannot answer questions about ultimate values in human life. In trying to understand nature in rational terms, Greeks stripped nature of all mythical and positive values. Although classical Greece was moving toward a secular existence free from religious control, it still had to face up to the problem of evil. Where could the source of evil be found? For Greeks, evil was where it was confronted, at the environmental front. As such, some Greek philosophies came to identify evil in the material existence. These Greeks of the Axial period saw the material world as the source of evil and the spiritual realm as the source of virtue. Therefore, humans must reject nature and seek a spiritual realm. Nature must be devalued with respect to the human spirit. This Greek negativity toward nature came largely from the experience of a failing environment, the agrarian economies and the urban problems associated with them. Negativity toward nature brought dualities of all sorts between spiritual and the material, rural and urban, and body and soul. By the time the Axial Age rolled by, Greek religions were in disarray and were losing vivacity. Gods of nature had failed and had to be discarded. Cities in Greece were at war with each other. Greek religion lacked an organizing principle, a central temple cult or a supreme deity that could unify the sundry city cults. The Greeks also lacked a national history that would unify them as one people. In spite of their lofty ideals of democracy and humanism, the cities of Greece fell an easy prey to the imperial tide. Greek imperialists reasoned that their hegemony would arrest the collapse of societies and economies of the Levant and the Fertile Crescent. In the pursuit of their hegemony, Greeks waged war against nature and society and established the Greek Empire. Both in Sumer and in Greece of classical times, nature myths were losing their relevance and their power to evoke moral response. As depicted in the Epic of Gilgamesh, humans were now thought of as the primary agents of value and change. Nature was pushed to the background. A new medium had to emerge that would serve as the organizing medium and carry the moral force. It was found in the narration of the human saga. It is in Sumer that human history becomes a viable medium for offering meaning and purpose to human existence. Nature and gods need not be entreated. Now the human story is narrated without entwining it with the saga of gods and nature, because the purpose of life is not evident in nature. God is not in nature, nor is truth multiple. Nature was deprived of its potential to narrate the story of gods and humans. History is thus a pure narration of facts and stories about humans. But much of the ancient history is about the dynastic reigns of monarchs, emperors, and their reign. Thus, as Samuel Kramer contends in his book, History Begins at Sumer, for the first time in the evolution of human societies, the contingency of narrating the human saga apart from that of nature and the gods befell the Sumerian city-states. The imperial powers that ensued brought into the Sumerian legacy of historicism. Brian Swim and Thomas Berry write, quote, "In the modern period, we are without a comprehensive story of the universe. The historians, even when articulating a world history, deal not with the whole world, but just with the human, as if the human were something separate from or an addendum to the story of the earth and the universe. The scientists have arrived at detailed accounts of the cosmos, but have focused exclusively on the physical dimensions and have ignored the human dimension of the universe." Unquote. The art of history, then, is to read the human saga as the prime event of the universe and to treat all other events as subservient to it. The Sumerians were the first to perceive the human drama as the central event in the universe, and they employed the art of writing to articulate this event very effectively. The Sumerian brand of historicism thus came to be the bedrock of the art of history writing and of Western civilization. The fundamental tenet of history is the defense of the estrangement of humans from nature and the conviction that human progress and exploits are central to the cosmic events and that untamed nature is an antagonist to human advance, an untamed beast out there waiting to be controlled and subdued by human ingenuity. Paul Shepard maintains that, quote, "The idea of history is itself a Western invention whose central theme is the rejection of habitat. It formulates experience outside of nature and tends to reduce place to location. To it, the plains and passes of the desert fringe are only a stage upon which the human drama is enacted. History conceives the past mainly in terms of biography and nations. It seeks causality in the conscious, spiritual, ambitious character of men and memorializes them in writing, unquote. Given Shepherd's love and passion for primal values and ways of life, we do not think that his judgment on history is overly harsh. Nevertheless, it would be unfair to burden the West with all the negativity toward nature. The art of history writing evolved and was refined millennia before Western historians could adopt it and become masters at it. However, writing was not originally invented for recording history. Rather, it was invented and employed to record economic transactions, and especially developed by the temple scribes who kept careful records of the stocks in their storehouses and the food distribution of to the common people. It was only much later, when the powers and hierarchy had developed, that writing was used to record history. In fact, it was the Sumerians and the Babylonians who used writing extensively for recording history as they understood it. History for them was the exploits of their royals and the brutal subjugation of the vassals, the common people, and the environment for enhancing the status of the emperors, monarchs, warlords, and urban bureaucrats. For Sumerians, Assyrians, and Babylonians, history was all about the exploits of their monarchs and warlords. Some of the earliest records of history are about the early dynastic period in Sumer from 2900 to 2400 BCE. A series of documents known as the Sumerian King Lists, engraved on clay tablets belonging to the late 3rd millennium, provide an account of ancient kings going back thousands of years. Most of the legal and moral codes of this era, like the Code of Hammurabi, a collection of Babylonian laws developed during the reign of Hammurabi, 1792 to 1750 BCE, were essentially enacted to justify and legitimize the privileges of the monarchs and the bureaucrats. Paul Shepherd is right in that the essential ideology of history, the rejection of habitat, was formalized when the art of history writing was mastered and standardized by the Greeks, Romans, and the Christian West. However, the seeds of this rejection were sown by the city dwellers of Sumer and nurtured by the imperial powers that grew in the Fertile Crescent centuries before the dawn of the Christian era. The genesis of the art of writing down history, urbanization, imperialism, and the rejection of nature grew hand in hand in the ancient world. Once the art of history writing was contrived, the urban, followed by imperial ideologies, came to permeate every area of human existence in the ancient society. Life became fragmented. Communities and cultures were destroyed. It was then that specialists developed their own sectarian interests and employed the art of narration to advance their own vested interests. Thus, the prophet and priests came to narrate the stories of gods. The court historians narrated the story of humans, especially the stories of monarchs and emperors. The philosopher-scientists, artists, and poets took up the task of expounding the process and taxonomies of nature. The myths of nature were replaced by numerous other myths, myths of history, messianic and eschatological myths, humanistic and personalistic values, and rational and scientific worldviews. The ancient urban ideology, as propounded here, was not written down as such. Until recently, it was not even discerned as a fundamental tenet of the urban and imperial designs. With the dawn of the age of ecology and the rise of green awareness, we are able to discern its uncanny presence in the various idiosyncrasies of urban and imperial societies, both ancient and modern. In fact, students of history laud the urbanism of yesterday for its ingenuity. Quote, "The golden age," unquote, of cities and civilizations, royal palaces and their harems, chivalry, pageantry, and pomposity enraptured all of us. In fact, archaeology thrives on yearnings for, quote, "lost civilizations." Historians and anthropologists brood over their demise. Most textbooks on world history list the contributions of early cities and imperial centers made to the advancement of human culture, especially to the fields of mathematics, astronomy, architecture, metallurgy, law, education, medicine, and government. Yet what has not been apparent to the students of archaeology and history until recently is the insidious ambivalence of the urban and imperial ideologies, their outright rejection of nature. On the other hand, we need to acknowledge that not all ancient cultures and ethnic histories reject nature. Egypt did not reject nature. Although Egypt could boast of a history that was ancient and continuous, the art of history and writing were not the primary vehicles for transmission of its culture. Egypt's culture was transmitted more through its burial artifacts, structures, and temple cults than by anything else. Egyptian religion and culture came to symbolize the essential goodness of nature and human dependence on it. Egyptians did not see their history outside of nature. In the case of Israel, we find that the art of history, both oral and written narrations, were used to transmit and reinforce Israel's religious, social values and traditions. During the 4 centuries of its monarchical existence, Israel's history was remembered and reenacted through its cultic exercises, festivals, and the observance of the law. Israel's awareness as a nation was wrapped up in the covenant ideology. Israel's national ideology was set in the covenant Yahweh had made with the patriarchs and its people. Covenant history integrates the sagas of Yahweh, Israel, and the land. Yahweh's promises to the wandering patriarchs, the Exodus event, sojourn in the wilderness, and the occupation of the promised land were the milestones on which the plot of Israel's history was pegged. For this reason, Israel's history was also bound up with the story of the promised land. Israel's history had no teleological purpose other than the covenantal existence in the promised land. All social, personal, and land ethics flowed from Israel's covenantal existence. But the land ethics that flowed from this covenantal ideology was highly utilitarian. In the mindset of Israelites, nature did not exist for its own sake. It had no intrinsic value other than to serve human ends. The land belonged to Yahweh. Yahweh bestowed the land upon Israel. Israel was commanded to live on the land, enjoy its fruits, and nurture it. Therefore, ultimately, Israel was accountable to Yahweh for the way the land was used and its fruits were enjoyed and shared. In spite of the utilitarian excesses, Israel did not reject nature per se, but Israel also did not romanticize it. On the heels of the urban civilization grew imperialism in the Fertile Crescent and the Levant. Axial movements unfolded with the spread of imperialism. Like Israel and Egypt, imperialists of the Akkadian, Babylonian, Assyrian, Persian, and Greek empires viewed nature with hostility and disdain and sought to subdue her with all their might. For them, nature was something to be dominated and ordered primarily for human use. Imperial ideologies, especially those that developed in Babylon and Greece, advanced the belief that humans were the most important species in the universe, and nature had no purpose other than to serve human ends. Nature was regarded as an alien, and human negativity toward nature became full-blown. Imperial powers had almost no concern for the health and welfare of the bioregions, or the people, and of the provinces and colonies. Nature suffered immensely during imperial times. Imperialism fractured communities and their affinity to the land. Imperialism functioned on the premise that nature must be subdued and plundered, for nature and the people who subsist on them exist to serve imperial powers and their fancies. Imperialists had no regard for ethnic histories and cultures. The world out there existed not for the common good, but as a territory over which imperialists could hold sway and establish their reign. Emperors became the ultimate symbols of all value and power. Society, culture, religion, nature, and history all revolved around the imperial office. The emperor was the frame of reference for culture and society, and the source of all power and values. Imperial powers were claimed to be the center and object of history. During the imperial epoch, gods and humans were totally extricated from nature. There was indeed no continuity between God, humans, and nature. Nevertheless, both gods and humans, especially the imperial powers, needed to be grounded and find legitimacy for their existence. They found this in each other's offices. Thus, the gods of the imperialists were now partnered with and grounded in the imperial office. Every emperor sought to create a cult of his own. From pharaohs to Caesars, all emperors cast themselves as semi-divine objects of worship. But every one of them failed and failed miserably. The common people saw the folly of it all. Imperialism destroyed old cultural and religious moorings. Now came the need to identify new grounds of organizing values. While imperial forces sought to create their own cults and myths, common people not associated with or opposed to the imperial movements sought to create new values and novel ways of living in the world. By proffering novel values for living, they were able to transcend the foibles and follies of imperial ideologies. Prophets, philosophers, and visionaries showed creative ways of living amidst the gloomiest of historical prospects and much evil in the society, including degraded ecosystems. Messianic movements, mystery cults, and new philosophies proliferated. The groundswell of new values for living, apocalypticism, secularism, rationalism, individualism, humanism, communalism, globalism, dualism, spiritualism, asceticism, especially in India, historicism, mysticism, and monasticism opened the floodgates of axial movements all across the core centers. These movements profoundly influenced the way humans would view and deal with nature. Nature was still there, and humans could not write her off completely. Besides, the problem of evil had to be addressed squarely. Evil was everywhere. People had to explain its presence and source. They needed myths that would mitigate the horrendous evil encountered on all fronts. Myths of nature were not good enough. Nature's myths by themselves had no moral fortitude in arresting social disintegration. If they were to have ethical force, they needed to be wedded to the myths of gods or history or humans. Even historical myths by themselves were of no use. Their promises vanished like desert mirages. Kingdoms and empires fell one after the other. Imperial powers and ideologies shifted constantly. People could not peg their hopes and aspirations on the promise of their particular histories or that of the imperial powers. Thoughtful people detested being coerced into global collectives. In these contexts, people now came to view themselves as shaped not so much by their local bioregional niches or of their ethnic histories, but by the global, communal, and personal existence. Axial movements took advantage of the climate and translated them into values for religion. Groups opposed to imperial excesses saw the value in small groups and solidarity cells. They refused to march to the drumbeat of the global collectives. We see this in the way imperial powers of Rome persecuted the early church, not so much for its worship of Christ as for its refusal to worship Caesar. It was in this critical ethos that new social and personal values were engendered. The virtues of love and caring for one another grew in these contexts of close-knit communities that had powerful influence in the life and the ministries of the early church. On the other hand, axial movements also came to depend on, quote, historical particulars, unquote. Historical particulars are central events that serve as the organizing foundation for the religious movements. It is immaterial whether such events occurred in the past or are anticipated in the future. Primitive Christianity came to be centered on the Jesus event, Jesus' crucifixion, death, resurrection, and second coming. This event served as the organizing principle of their cultic and communal existence. The rituals of baptism and communion revolve around the Jesus event. Although primitive Christianity grew initially within the Jewish tradition, Jewish history and Mosaic laws became meaningless when Christianity spread through the Greco-Roman world. For the Jews, the expected coming of the Messiah and the restoration of the temple cult are central to their religious existence. Christianity had to opt for a new organizing center, which it found in the Jesus event. Some parallels of this can also be found in other axial traditions. Very often, these historical, social, and personal particulars center on human individuals who are deified and made to attain superhuman qualities and characters. Scores of myths are created surrounding the life and death of such individuals to such an extent that these myths come to evoke awe and adoration for that individual among the faithful. Nevertheless, in spite of these historical, social, local, and personal particulars and the newfound communal and personal values for religion, for all practical purposes, axial people's attitude to the world of nature was largely negative. Primitive Christianity, especially the churches formed by the Apostle Paul, grew in urban contexts of the Greco-Roman cities. People living in Greco-Roman cities were largely removed from rural agrarian settings. Environmentally, they were alienated. Socially, they had lived within a hierarchically structured society made up of aristocrats, the landowners, artisans, and slaves. Early Christians were drawn largely from the common people who lived in the cities. And early Christian groups, caught up in the depths of despair and anxiety from the persecution perpetrated by the imperial powers of Rome, overwhelmingly opted for apocalyptic aspirations. It was in these anonymous, urban, and global contexts that people came to seek liberation and redemption from the travails of terrestrial existence. The imperial movements of the axial times had alienated humans from the world of nature. Axial humans now aspired for a higher realm of existence, a realm more enduring than the present one, which is prone to decay and destruction. The general premise of axial traditions begins with the conviction that human existence is defective, unsatisfactory, lacking, so that humans should seek liberation from this temporal existence to a realm that is durable and holistic. Axial soteriology promises not only a release from sickness, pains, and death, but also a release from harsh human realities of the physical world. The pre-axial world was collapsing on all fronts, environmental, political, moral, and social. Drastic changes were needed. Farming and pastoral pursuits were failing. Evils of urban and imperial advances brought misery, both for the body and soul. Diseases, epidemics, and starvation ravaged urban and rural societies. People were weary of this world. The world of nature could no longer be thought of as a source of human happiness and fulfillment. The liberation from societal, terrestrial, and corporal decay alone would ensure eternal peace and rest. It was in this context that we see soteriological schemes acquiring eschatological and apocalyptic significance. Humans are now called to await the arrival of a new heaven and a new earth and the cessation of history. A new heaven and a new earth are desirable to a world out there that is disintegrating. A commitment to this soteriological scheme assures a place in the world to come. Of course, there were exceptions to these world-negating soteriologies. The Apostle Paul occasionally wrote about the redemption of the created world, and the Stoics affirmed life in this world. But these were far few and far between to be counter-effective to the overall thrust of the axial negativity toward nature and life. Ultimately, this axial negativity contributed to the human predilection for cosmic homelessness and a soteriology that sought an escape and a release from the temporality of this world. And this disposition of cosmic homelessness is fundamentally common to most, if not all, axial traditions. Epilogue. Toward Eartheism, a postmodern spirituality. Cosmic homelessness permeates every sphere of human life in the modern world. Our technologies, science, and lifestyle are tinged through and through with this habit of mind that has become entrenched over thousands of years, causing human disenchantment with nature. In our opinion, both cosmic homelessness and human disenchantment with nature can be ultimately traced to climate change. With our collective awareness of what we confront on the environmental front, we may now be able to dislodge them. Nevertheless, their moorings are still set within the religious traditions formed during the Axial Age, and that is why we seek the aid of religious and spiritual forces to uproot them. The Axial movement is fundamentally a spiritual movement. Although Axial spirituality was negative toward nature and corporal existence, the axial commitment to liberation and transcendence from terrestrial existence that was unsatisfactory nudged the revolution toward novel forms of religious experiences. Early Christians in the Greco-Roman cities experienced the spirituality in personal and group settings. These new modes of existence brought forth much that was good. Axial spirituality created new social and personal values and ethics unheard of in ancient societies. For the first time in history, humans were able to reach deep down into the depths of their psyche, their soul, and draw out the needed moral and spiritual resources and ideals for living. They could do this without any recourse to the world out there, or invoking the spirit of nature or the forces of history. At times, even the divine was ignored or not invoked. some Eastern traditions have become successful in charting spiritual paths without invoking divine grace. Along with personal values, axial spirituality also provided communal values, fellowship groups and solidarity cells that grew to serve the needs of the alienated individuals engendered rich resources for social ethics and communal living. Movements that grew out of axial revolution thus came to hold great possibilities for transforming human societies, individuals, and cultures. Although axial spirituality was experienced in a communal context, it did not encompass the non-human world because axial societies themselves were alienated from the non-human world. The grounds for religious existence were truncated and narrowly experienced devoid of eco-spirituality. Nature did not serve as a source of spirituality, especially among the traditions that grew in and around the Fertile Crescent. In rejecting the world and seeking liberation from all physical, material, and terrestrial existence, axial movements made a decisive shift toward the spirituality of transcendence. The discipline of religion as we know it conforms to the norms of the spirituality of transcendence. These norms are grounded on personal and social particularities that have evolved with and draw heavily from the anthropocentric and anti-nature motifs of the axial traditions. Anthropocentrism truncates divine grace largely to advanced human welfare and power. The non-human world is denied access to divine grace. Nature merely serves as a backdrop for the enactment of the divine human drama. From the pre-axial times to the modern age, nature's intrinsic values have been gradually replaced with instrumental values. It exists now merely to serve human ends, and the sanction to deal with nature in terms of instrumental values was largely derived from the axial traditions. Ultimately, nature was excommunicated from the community of faith, especially in the traditions that grew in and around the Fertile Crescent. The net result is the disenchantment with nature that steers humanity toward self-destruction in destroying the non-human world. The history of religion shows that the prehistoric cults, cults that venerated the Magna Mater, engendered pro-nature attitudes. Could we prop up the Magna Mater or the Earth Mother cultures again? Or should we opt for an alternative religious paradigm that is devoid of human arrogance and anti-nature stances? Conversations on Gaia, planetism, earthism, and holism, as opposed to economism and anthropocentrism, gropes for alternative religious paradigms anticipated by a postmodern world. Could earthism, advocated by John Cobb, serve as the paradigm of the postmodern world? In the context of climate change, aren't these conversations, which are based on a premise of an earth that is either friendly or hostile towards humans, fundamentally misguided? We need to lay fresh grounds for an alternate praxis of religion. If we seek to address the environmental crisis as a religious crisis, we need to have a new understanding of religion that looks for a radical new spirituality of transcendence and immanence, a spirituality that both transcends the world as well as stamps the cosmos in the human soul. The time is ripe for the axle to turn once again. To the ongoing search for an alternate paradigm, may we proffer earthism? Earthism is a spiritual stratagem that doggedly affirms the ultimacy of both God and the world. It is indeed a challenge to theists for whom God alone is absolute and the ultimate, and to the eco-humanists, the universe alone is ultimate and enduring. Nevertheless, earthism needs to be on guard. Left to itself, it will slip down the treacherous path of idolatry so prevalent in some nature cults. Therefore, we plead for its affiliation with traditions that flout idolatry of any kind. The preamble of the Earthiest Creed affirms, quote, "We believe in God, the creator of the universe, and a universe which enriches God continually," unquote. The earthism anticipated by the postmodern world will absorb the attention of scholars in the days to come. Would Christianity itself be part of those movements that anticipate a third paradigm shift in the dawn of the age of earthism? It's a question left open for further exploration.